This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest this week is Ishmael Beya, author of A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. Ishmael Beya, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your book, which is just an astonishing account, I've got to say, starts off with you as a fan of hip-hop. Tell me, when you were a young boy in Sierra Leone, what the appeal of hip-hop was for you.
Well, there was an American mining company in the area that I grew up, and through this company came American popular culture, and one of them was hip-hop music. My love for it, I really came for the poetry and the love for words, you know. I grew up, even though I went to school and learned English, I didn't really speak English at home. So to hear somebody who I felt had a mastery of the English language and could speak it so fast was very appealing to me. That was my love.
And in a way, your interest in hip hop and in that music and in performing led you to the day that you got separated from your parents. Can you tell that story?
Yes, my older brother Junior and some friends who were our age, and we had were interested in this music, but we also went out to perform in talent shows to lip sync some of these songs, and sometimes to make up our own lyrics. And so we had gone to a town called Matrujong, actually, to a talent show, When the World Reached Mokgbemo, which is where I grew up. And then this is when our first encounter with the war really started. Prior to that, we'd heard about it. But this is when we really began to experience it firsthand.
And you experienced it firsthand because you were unable to go home.
Yes. We tried to go back from Matrujong to Mokgbemo, which is about 17 miles. And so during that walk is when we began to see children who had been separated from their families, people who had been shot in different parts of their body, people carrying their dead children, and things of that sort. And this is when this landscape that I grew up as a child, I used to walk that path, that road, I wouldn't be afraid at all. But now it became even difficult to walk.
I mean, that must have been a horrifying scene, that first glimpse.
The first glimpse was very difficult for me because we had heard of it, but we couldn't believe it because we grew up in a culture where people were very kind to each other. There was a strong sense of community. So when people who had experienced this sort of thing told us, we didn't believe it until we really saw it. And at this point, you know, I was 12 years old. As a 12-year-old kid, it was too difficult to understand why was this happening. And there was no one to explain to you at all because everyone started to fear each other so deeply, you know.
And then not being able to see your parents that night or the next night, and that must have been traumatic.
Yes, I think that there was the trauma was also not only about what we were seeing, but the sense of uncertainty, you know, not knowing when this will end, where are we going, where are our families, we will see them again. And so it became constant running, constant. Basically, our lives went from young people who thought of a future to now, can we live to the next minute? And if we lived, can we live to the next? That became our lives.
And how did you live minute to minute?
Well, that required basically running from the war constantly, learning things such as that we never really knew in this culture, that running during the nighttime from the war, you had more chances of staying alive. In the day, you could be struck by stray bullets. And learning things like that. Learning to go hungry for days without eating, you know.
And what would you eat in the woods? Mostly this was through the woods?
Yeah, through the woods. Sometimes we went through towns and villages that had been abandoned. And sometimes, you know, near some of these towns and villages, they had cassava farms or they had oranges or bananas and things like that. But because everyone was doing the same thing, those fruits were gone very quickly.
You know? Yeah, you said sometimes in this book, A Long Way Gone, you had to get the very underripe fruit, but it was all the only thing you could find.
Yep. Sometimes even raw bananas. We had to eat raw bananas, but it's the only thing you could find. And sometimes there were no pots to even boil anything. So you ate what you could find, you know. And sometimes also as a child running, one of the difficulties that came about also because young people were being forced to fight into this war, people feared children. So when they saw you in a group, as I was running with a group of kids, people ran away from us. So that also meant we didn't have to go through certain towns and villages because we'd be attacked.
What was your first exposure to the rebels, the RUF rebels?
Well, the first time I'd seen the war, and also when I was in Matrujong after I'd started running from this war, they attacked it and we escaped. But my first encounter with them really was trying to come back into Matrujong to find food, and we were basically captured by a group of rebels in a very open area and brought to this one town, and we were told that we would be recruited. And so they were basically looking at us and looking at how strong you were, whether they could put you. And that was my first encounter.
But they didn't recruit you.
Not that night. They didn't recruit me, not that night. But, but I think it was the first time I saw some of the kids, really, very close in person. Some of them were as young as me. Some of them were slightly older.
The rebel kids.
The rebel kids, the RUF kids, wearing lots of watches on their arms.
And what is the symbolism of that?
It's just because they looted a lot of things. And so they wore a lot of things. They were wearing baseball hats, you know. Some of them were wearing, like, you know, T-shirts, you know, and things like that. And it just, it wasn't like an army that you would see with boots and helmets. It was people wearing shorts, you know.
Now, on that first encounter in this book, A Long Way Gone, Ishmael Beya, you talk about what seemed to be, it looked like you were about to be killed.
Yes, we were going to be killed, because one of the things that had happened that I wasn't selected when the second selection process came, because I was trembling, and they said, "Oh, this guy is weak." So, and basically, we were those who were not selected when these things happen are killed as a way to bring the young recruiters, or show them blood, as they will say. They want to show the young recruiters, the new recruiters, blood so that they can be strong. So they kill people in front of them to force them to be killed. And so we're actually going to be executed as a way to indoctrinate these other young people, including my elder brother who had been selected on the other group, you know.
And how did you escape that?
Well, when we were being taken to the edge of the river to be sort of slaughtered, I guess, there was a sound that came from, I don't know if it was soldiers approaching or whatever it was, but this caused the rebels to run off. And basically they began shooting. And so everyone, those selected and those not selected, saw this in an open window, and everyone just kind of ran into different parts of the bush. And that's how I was able to survive, you know, for that night at least.
And then tell our listeners the story of how you almost found your parents. Because to me, this is one of the most emotional parts of this very emotional book, A Long Way Gone.
Well, I'd been running from the war between the ages of 12 and 13 for quite many, many months. And the only thing that really kept me alive, I believe, was the feeling that I could find my family, that they could be alive somewhere. And I was with a group of other kids, about seven of us, and we kept asking people we met along the way that we could talk to about whether they knew where our families were. And we finally met a woman who said, "Oh, I knew where all your families are in this village. Actually, your older brother actually is even living there." And even to make that believable more, we encountered a man called Gassimo, who used to live next door to me in Mogwemo. And he said, "Oh, yeah, they're going to be so happy to see you. They had been so worried. They thought you died or something like that." And so, you know, I was very anxious now to get to this village. But by the time we arrived in the village, we were at the outskirts of the village when we started seeing fire smoke coming up, and we heard gunshots. And I wanted to run into the village, but Gassimo wouldn't allow it. And so after the gunshots faded and the smoke was down a little bit, we went to the village, and this village was burnt down completely. People were put in houses and burnt, and people were lined up and shot. And so this is basically how I lost my family. And at that point, the pain was so difficult that I didn't want to be alive, you know. I felt that it would have been easier at that time to just be in the village with them, to even see them at least one time, you know. If that had cost me my life, at this point, I preferred that, you know.
And so how do you keep going after seeing such things?
Well, when I saw this, actually, I had lost all sense of hope in myself. I think the only reason what kept me going is that I was with a group of other kids who helped me to move, to keep walking along. I had lost, I was very angry. I even attacked Gassimo because I blamed him for slowing us down and not allowing me to see my family again. And I wounded him, and, you know, so at this point I'd become so angry, and also I had lost sense of, you know, this is the time I was 12, this, you know, I went from having a family to not having any, and so there was nowhere I can go. I had no home, I had no family any longer, so it was very difficult, you know.
I'm speaking with Ishmael Beya, author of A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier, about his time in Sierra Leone during the Civil War. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. You then became, at some point, recruited into the government army.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, after my family had been killed, and not it wasn't only my family, it was also families of other kids that I was running with. We ended up wandering, and then we went to a military base, thinking as young people that this would be the safest place to go, to run from the rebels. Little did we know that actually there had been a splinter of a good number of Sierra Leone armed groups that were now, that had been disenfranchised from squads and big units, and they were doing basically what the rebels were doing. So we went to this village called Yile, and we were there. In the beginning, it seemed all right. You know, we just only helped them to cook, and we had shelter. We could eat some food. So it was okay. But then as time went on, we were basically asked to, you know, basically given no choice. Either you joined or you leave. Now, from somebody who's looking at this from outside, they would think it was a choice. But once you've looked for safety amongst one group, you cannot leave because young people also use the spies. So when you leave one squad or one group of fighting force to another, the other people will kill you immediately upon sight. So we couldn't leave. And so we were basically trained briefly, about less than a week, really. We didn't really know what we were doing, you know, after that. And that's how the madness started, really.
And what was the training for the madness?
Well, the training for the madness, there were several things. First of all was to basically learn the simple commands, how to crawl, how to move and do this and that, but also how to shoot the AK-47 and various, you know, lightweight weapons. And perfection really came by being in a war. But there was also a rhetoric of revenge that was a very strong part of it, which is that they knew almost all the kids in the village were orphans and had lost their family through either brutal killings and things like that. So they basically reminded you of that, you know, that the rebels are responsible for what had happened to you. And so what would you do if you see a rebel that killed your family? And this was the sort of the mantra, you know, repeated, you know, what would you do to him? And the commander would say, this is what I would do. And so basically this got us very angry. In addition, there were lots of drugs and coercion and their exhibition killings to make everyone sort of complicit to this madness. And with all these things, basically, our lives changed tremendously from children to now soldiers.
Exhibition killings, what was that?
Exhibition killings were also a way to indoctrinate people. And one of the ways that they did it was that after we had gone on raids and prisoners had been captured, and this was a war where there were no prisoners, you know. When prisoners were captured, they were brought to the base. And at this base, soldiers were selected. And one time I happened to be one of the people. And you were given a knife, a bayonet, and asked to kill the prisoner that is set in front of you. And they would count. And then one of the commanders would shoot a weapon, and then you would start. And so basically, whoever could kill a prisoner quicker with a bayonet won the competition. And there would be people lining around, all soldiers, all boys and men who had been traumatized as well, screaming and basically celebrating this. And when you won, which I won in my during when it was my time, you were given a position, a post.
Now, how did it feel at the time? And then how does it feel now at some distance?
Well, at the time when I was there, because I had lost myself completely, again, when I was writing this book, is really what I wanted to do. I wanted people to understand how I felt then, not how I feel now about what happened, because I wanted people to understand how that change comes. When I was there, I felt good about it at this point. You know, it felt that I was doing something that was great. I felt that sense of bravery. I felt that I was doing something that could prevent this from happening to other children. So when I won the competition, I was actually given a junior lieutenant, and I was very happy about it. And you know, it's the same thing also when you're dragged into the war. In the beginning, you fear, but as time goes on, this group replaces the family that you've lost. And in order to be a part of them, to show loyalty requires violence. And violence becomes a way to stay alive, to function, and so even to the point that you celebrate it. And so I wanted people to understand that, you know. Now, obviously, in my right mind, the things that I did or the things that I went in, if anyone pushes me to do it in my right mind, I would not do it at all. But at this point, it was either that or this had become a way to stay alive, actually.
You write that before that, in battle, that first battle, you had killed someone, and you write that my mind snapped during the first killing. It was after that that you were able to do this. And somehow there must be a process in the mind that makes it easier.
Yes. I think what happens is that because I was exposed to so much violence and so much killing that I was a part of as well, what happens at some point is that I think the mind and the body shuts down, giving emotional responses. You know, in the beginning, when people were killed in front of me or when I saw people who had been killed recently, I would vomit. I would become nauseated. But as time went on, there was so much of it that it became normalized, you know. So it becomes normalized to the point that you no longer have any reaction. We went to the point, and also with the drugs, you know, so we got to the point where we could not even feel for ourselves, our own body. So no longer did we have, we'd lost the ability to have any emotional response to anything. And that's how you're able to function. It becomes normalized. And that's why they go after children, because children particularly can normalize these kinds of things very quickly, you know.
And do you think... you know, adults and adolescents, older 18, 19-year-olds who are in a lot of wars, they normalize it too, evidently.
Yep.
Is it your belief, looking back on everything, that anyone in your circumstance or any human being can be indoctrinated enough into committing an atrocity?
Yes. That's part of the reason why I wrote this book, because I think oftentimes, because this reality perhaps seems so far removed from people's life, they might think they are capable of doing it. We're not. We said that once upon a time when the war was in neighboring Liberia. We heard the same things. We would say, you know, as a kid growing up, I was just a funny kid, simple kid, you know. I didn't think I would be capable of it. All of us are capable of losing our humanity and regaining it with circumstances that force us. You know, I would have never believed that I could do the things that I did before the war. But then there I was, you know.
Ishmael Bey, author of A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. How did you regain your humanity?
It took a long time. What happened was that there had been such a rampant use of children in the war on both sides. The rebel groups, the RUF, was using children. The army was using children. And then later on, a group called the Kamajor. And there was a group called the West Side. So everyone was using children in the war, children fighting children and so on and so forth. So UN agencies such as UNICEF and other agencies went into Sierra Leone and started going into the bushes to talk to the commanders and set up local rehabilitation centers with local organizations. And they would remove the children and bring them to the rehabilitation center. And this is how I was removed from the war and the rehabilitation process started.
I was surprised that your commanding officer let you go so easily.
I've been asked many times, why did I think I was released? Because I felt I was quite a good soldier. And the only explanation that I don't know is what I would say, but another explanation that I could think of is that I was very small as a kid, very skinny. And so I think because I've thought about it quite a while, when the UNICEF workers came, most of us who were given up that day were the kids who looked physically like children. There were some kids who were our age, but who were much bigger and bulkier, were not given that day. So I think because UNICEF workers were probably looking at us and see that these are the most child-looking ones, you know, that's probably why we were giving up, but I don't know.
No, I read somewhere that you said that being rehabilitated as a civilian was more difficult than being habilitated into being a child soldier. What was so hard about being rehabilitated?
Well, being rehabilitated is that, first of all, I had to relearn how to be a human being again from scratch. I had forgotten how to sleep, even. I'd forgotten how to trust people. I didn't trust in happiness. I learned that sadness was easier, you know, other than going back and forth. I didn't trust in adults at all. And when you're in the war, when you're dragged into it very quickly, you have no choice. It's either killed or be killed. And while you're there, you don't have time to really emotionally be with the memories because it's constantly happening. And now when you're no longer in the war, you have to learn how to function with the memories of the war. It's something that you will never forget, in my opinion. You know, so you have to learn how to function with them. So all of these things are very, very difficult.
Now, in the first couple of days there of rehabilitation, there was brutality going on among the boys.
Yes. I mean, where we were there for many months, there are brutalities all the time. Because, again, we learned to function with violence only. And that's what we had known. I was in the war for a little over 2 years. And that had become our life, violence, constantly. It was celebrated when you committed violence. So, again, you had to learn how to believe that it's not only through violence you can achieve anything, but that's all we knew. So even when there was no one to project the violence, so sometimes we projected it to ourselves. There were times where we, you know, one of my friends, even myself, we punched just in mirrors you know, and your hand will bleed and things like that. So sometimes they had to inject us or give us medicine so we can sleep, so we won't hurt ourselves, you know, because we've become so destructive.
The nurses and the other caregivers at the rehabilitation center annoyed you, you write in this book, A Long Way Gone, that they kept saying, it's not your fault, it's not your fault, and you recoiled from that. Why?
Well, when you come from the war as a soldier, you know, you're thinking of yourself, not as a kid, but as a soldier who is capable of a few days ago to determine who lives or who died. And all of a sudden you're in this place where we considered people who are not fought civilians, which meant that you can do anything to them. So when a civilian says, oh, it's not your fault, it's almost belittling everything you've done. And at this point, we believe that what we had done was right. So that was where the anger came from. But it also required us to understand what they really meant by that. You know?
And how did you come to that understanding?
Well, I think it first began just the curiosity, because each time we would hurt some of these staff members, you know, we'll beat them, some fainted, so stab some of them, and they returned with a bandaged arm. And they always say, it's not your fault. You know, have you eaten any food? And we, in the beginning, we used to think, what's wrong with these people, you know? Why are they so crazy? So we began to wonder, why do they keep coming back when we've clearly made it clear to them that we don't want them? So it was that curiosity that led us to begin developing relationship with some of them to really know whether they really cared or whether it was just something they were saying to make us feel better. And through this, I befriended a nurse called Esther, who really was very pivotal in sort of setting me on the path of recovery.
Mm-hmm. And how'd she do that?
Well, the first time, you know, she was the nurse, so I would go to the hospital. I cut my hand and I went to the hospital, and I had fainted a few times and I was at the hospital. And so she took care of me. And one of the things that I did when she tried to press me to talk to her about it, I tried to tell her one of the most violent things I could think about in the war to deter her from ever asking me, but that didn't work the way I wanted it. And also, through our preliminary schooling, she had learned that I had a love for music. So she bought me music, and so she reminded me of things before the war.
She got you some hip-hop tapes, she got some reggae,
Bob Marley tapes, and things like that, you know.
And so she reconnected with part of you that you had lost.
Yes, she made me reconnect. And I think when I began to see that things were changing about me is when I would look forward to her coming to work. Prior to that, I didn't really care about anyone else. And when I began to look forward to her coming to work is when I knew that. But I would not admit it to her at all. You know, I was still trying to pretend I was tough. I would not tell her that I was, you know.
And then somehow you were chosen to come to New York to speak at a UN meeting. What was that about?
That since I came from the war, I think my life had gone to very interesting extremes. You know, I came from the war and I started living with my uncle, who was the only family member they could find.
With your uncle?
With my uncle in the capital, Sierra Leone. And it was the first time I met him. I never met him prior to that. And I was selected to go for an interview to come to New York and speak about what was happening to children. And this is when a woman called Graca Machel, the wife of Nelson Mandela, had done a study about, you know, armed conflict in children around the world. And so the interview that I went for, I told off the guy because I was really upset at the way the interview was being conducted by kids who live in the capital city who had not been through the war, who were supposed to be coming here to the United States to speak about what. So I told them off and I left.
How'd you
tell
them
off?
And
then I got selected. Well, I basically told, you know, I was sitting in the chair and I basically told him, you know, I said, well, who are these people that are standing back there? You know, what are they going to say to people when they go to New York if they haven't lived in the war at all? They've only seen traces of it in the city. This is kind of ridiculous. So I stormed out of the place and then I got selected. So I wasn't looking forward to going anywhere, you know.
What was the experience like in New York?
Oh, it was the first time I left Sierra Leone. And just to give a context to that, I grew up in the countryside where I didn't have electricity or tap water, and even in the capital city. And so you can imagine, first time I had a passport, it was the first time I was on a plane. It was the first time I came anywhere. It was winter. I come from a place in Sierra Leone where if it drops below 60, people begin to find their jackets already. So you can imagine. But also I had a relationship with hip-hop early on, so I heard rap about New York and sometimes violent. So I wasn't looking forward to actually being in New York because I didn't think I wanted to be on the street that was violent. Again, I came from violence, you know. But it was really overwhelming and absolutely cold. I didn't think I would come back.
And now you're living in the United States.
Yes, I live in New York now.
And what are you doing?
Well, besides going around and speaking about the book since it came out, one of the things that I'm doing is also I work with Human Rights Watch, and I'm a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador for Children in Armed Conflict. And I also do work with the UN Office for Children in Armed Conflict. And all of this is to continue advocacy work, to do research and find ways to talk to policymakers, whether in Washington or, you know, people coming from various governments at the UN, to really find a way to prevent the use of children in war.
And how do you do that? I mean, there are countries around the world and rebel units around the world that are still conscripting children. And what hope is there to prevent that ultimately?
There is hope. I don't want to give up, because for me particularly, I think because people didn't give up, I'm here. So I believe that things can be done. But it is difficult to prevent wars, particularly which once wars start, children will be used. That's the difficult part. So for now, one of the things that we try to do is to convince government to allow UN agencies to go in and set up rehabilitation centers so that those children who can escape can have a place to go. And secondly, is to find a very creative way. For example, one of the things we tried to do with the U.S. government, and part of it was successful, was trying to have them agree to make it a requirement that when they give a military aid to any country, that country should not have a use of child soldiers, whether paramilitary groups or whether army groups. And if you make that a requirement, and governments like Colombia, which there's a strong use of child soldiers there, if they know that they can't get military aid from the U.S. because they're recruiting child soldiers, they will do something about it.
Have they done something, though? Because the U.S. gives them a lot of money.
Yeah, well, we haven't gotten the U.S. to agree on that particular requirement yet. What they've agreed on through Senator Durbin from Illinois, who actually spearheaded it, was that they've put into law, it's now a federal crime in the United States, that if you recruit if you recruit a child soldier, or you are a commander of an army, and you show up in the United States, you'll be prosecuted under federal law. So, you know, we're making some headway, but it is difficult to, you know.
And how are you doing, Ishmael Beya? Do you still have nightmares? How do you deal with these memories? I know you've written them. That maybe that was cathartic, but I can't imagine going through the things that you went through without still some of it haunting you. How do you wrestle with that?
Well, I think oftentimes people think that recovering from this means forgetting. It's not. It means learning to live with the memories of the war. I still have nightmares every now and then. I still have flashbacks. My life is colored by that experience, you know. I remember when I first arrived in the United States and my first July 4th, I was not very happy, because for me, the sounds of fireworks do not remind me of pleasure, you know. I wanted to get out of town. I was already packing my bag, telling him, you know, trying to think of how I can escape. So, you know, if somebody runs past me really fast on the street, it can trigger something, you know. So I've just learned to function with it and transform the experience. So I've transformed it positively. For example, because of the war, I have insomnia problems. I don't sleep very well, you know, because I had to learn how to sleep in the nightmares. But I don't think that's a problem, because when I was in university, this was an advantage to me. I couldn't sleep, so I did my work ahead of time, you know. I've come to appreciate what it means to be alive, you know, just to wake up in the morning in peace. So that's how I've been able. But still, the nightmares and the flashbacks are there, you know. Hmm.
Ishmael Beya is the author of A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. It is an incredible story, and I highly recommend it. You work with Human Rights Watch, with UNICEF, and you also have a foundation, the Ishmael Beya Foundation. So I would encourage listeners to go to any of those organizations to see if you could help work on this issue or find out more about this issue of child soldiers and how to prevent children from being conscripted into war. Ishmael Beya, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella, an engineer at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.